Most highly successful people live in a state of creative and happy emptiness. Unlike average people who become overly absorbed in what they are thinking about, dealing with currently, anticipating or remembering, individuals who think relationally, from the center of the circle of consciousness, can see opportunities that other people overlook, and simultaneously create rapid relations that enable them to quickly and successfully seize these opportunities and avoid disasters. To sum it all up in overly simplistic terms, Master Fuap said tersely, success in life primarily depends on two things, timing, and a person's ability to create rapid and accurate relations within one's own mind. But wait a second, Master Fuap. How does thinking relationally affect my walking past the most beautiful girl I have ever seen? If you were thinking logically, he replied with a laugh, you would probably not react properly or quickly enough to meet and impress her. Logically, if she was the most beautiful woman you had ever seen, you would be so overwhelmed by her beauty that you wouldn't react quickly enough, and you would miss the opportunity to introduce yourself to her. Or you would react logically. You might like to meet her, but remember you are on your way to school. You might not have enough time to meet her without being late to class. Also, how would you react? He inquired rhetorically. Using logic, you could only rely on your past experiences, those that are in your current memory, to draw information from, on how to approach her. You would have to think quickly of a way to create a logical relationship between yourself and what you were going to say to her. But by the time you got all of this constructed in your mind, chances are she would be long gone. But Master Fuap, I stammered, I don't see how thinking relationally, or not thinking at all, or whatever it is you are trying to explain to me, would help me to meet and impress her. It is easier than you realize, but you must think relationally to understand what I am talking about, he replied with a soft chuckle. As I said before, he continued, the mind is like an onion. It is made up of countless layers. The layers closest to the surface of your conscious awareness are the storehouse of your memories and experiences from your current lifetime. But beneath those layers are deeper layers that contain your past life experiences, and deeper still there are layers that access the pure intelligence of the universe itself, which I refer to as the second attention. When you think relationally, when you have the full awareness of your mind, all of those layers are at your disposal. You can immediately draw information from your past lives or, if the information you want can't even be found there, you can draw information directly from your second attention. Perhaps you have had many past lives in which you knew equally beautiful women, Master Fuap said seductively. You could draw information about the best way to react and speak to her from your past life memories. And if you think relationally, via the second attention, you could access that information instantly. From the center of the circle, you can instantly find whatever it is you need to know, Master Fuap explained, in order to react properly to any situation. Trust me, this is true. Master Fuap, how can this be? There are two ways of doing things in life, Master Fuap replied. One way is to do things in and through structures. The other way is to do things by going outside structures. But there is another way to build a house. The Tantric Buddhist way. You first let the site select you. Then you go there and allow the site's power to show you what type of house should be built there, and then you build it. So what does that have to do with the second attention? I was starting to get confused by Master Fuap's explanation, and I wanted him to clear up my lack of understanding before he went any further. Well, Master Fuap said in a bright and happy tone. I suppose it has everything to do with the second attention. That's my point. But Master Fuap, I protested, what is the second attention? The second attention is the magical side of life, he calmly replied. There are two sides to existence, the side you see and the side you don't. The side that you see is the first attention, and the side you don't see is the second attention. Master Fuap paused, and looked at me. In the dim light of the cave I could vaguely make out enough of his facial expression to tell that he was very proud of what he had just said, even though I didn't know why. The second attention, he continued, is beyond structures. By structures I mean the dimensions of time, space and mind. The second attention is a field of endless light that exists just beyond our grasp. It is the home of what human beings call magic and miracles. I still don't understand what it is, I complained. Oh yes you do, he remarked casually. You use the second attention whenever you go snowboarding, that is why you are able to do it so well. Most people don't believe in the second attention, he factually stated. They have never experienced it, even though it surrounds them and the world they live in, all of the time. The second attention is the power of life, he declared. It exists within every atom of the universe, it is the power behind perception and all things which you perceive. You see, my young friend, Master Fuap was suddenly more gentle, as if he was explaining something very complicated to a small child. There are many unseen miracles of life. The very existence of the universe is a miracle. The fact that we live and are aware is a miracle. The fact that we die and are reborn is a miracle. These things cannot be understood by the thinking and calculating portions of our mind. We can examine aspects of these miracles with those parts of our mind, but we can never truly understand them. The second attention is an essence, he continued. It exists whether we are aware of it or not. Through the practice of short path tantric Buddhist yoga, we learn to become a bridge between the power of the second attention, the world of magic, and the dimensionality of the first attention, which is, of course, the day-to-day world we normally live in. Through meditation and other tantric practices, we learn to tap into the magical side of creation. This is the invisible side of life that underlies and supports all of the universes. The second attention is ancient and powerful, he said abruptly. It doesn't care for our puny reason. It can do things that are unimaginable. As a matter of fact, it does them all the time. And when you allow its power to pulse through you, then you and your life become the vehicle of some of its magic. So, Master Fuap, what does all of this have to do with yoga and enlightenment? It is easy, he replied. Normally it takes many incarnations of yogic practice for people to make major structural changes in their vibratory patterns and in the universes they have the ability to incarnate in. But when the power of the second attention is released into the practice of yoga, or anything for that matter, the miracle power of the universe enters into it, allowing things that would normally take place at a much slower pace to occur much faster. It even makes some things happen that would otherwise be totally impossible. So then why doesn't everyone who practices Buddhism use the second attention? I asked. What do you mean by that, Master Fuap? Most Buddhists, and the most people for that matter, are easily satisfied, and I assure you there is nothing wrong with that. But some of us are drawn to more. It is our karma. We want to go further into enlightenment and deeper into ecstasy, we want to merge with and become the totality of enlightenment. We want to transcend the self as soon as possible. So those people who want to attain enlightenment as quickly as possible practice tantric Buddhism. Because tantric Buddhism is the fastest path for attaining enlightenment, it's really that simple. But what does that have to do with me? I inquired suspiciously. Let me just say, Master Fuap replied with mock chastisement, that you, like a tantric Buddhist, are a person who seeks peak experiences. Most people your age wouldn't need to leave their native country, where there are plenty of high mountains to go snowboarding on, and travel all the way to the Himalayas to snowboard. But you needed to. It is part of your karma, because you are the way that you are. Is that wrong, Master Fuap? Am I being greedy? No, not at all. It is simply how you work. People who seek enlightenment rapidly on the tantric short path, as I did, and someone like yourself, who wants to snowboard the highest and the most majestic mountains in the world, are not being greedy. It is simply what their karma draws them to. The important thing, from a yogic point of view, he continued, is not to become egotistical. If a person who follows the tantric short path to enlightenment feels spiritually superior to someone who is following a more gradual path to enlightenment, then that person is making a great mistake, and is missing the entire point of the practice of yoga. Practicing yoga, Master Fuap continued, teaches us that we are all the same. We may have different external tendencies from other people we know, and we may also have different awareness levels, but inwardly we are all one. When you feel that you are superior to someone else, you lack compassion. Compassion is a word Buddhists use to express the realization that even though we may differ greatly in evolution, appearance, talents or intelligence from other beings in the universe, we are all equally valuable in the eyes of eternity. This is wisdom. When you feel superior to someone else, he continued, whether it's on the pathway to enlightenment, in the sport of snowboarding, in business or in any other aspect of your life, you cut yourself off from the inner light of enlightenment. You no longer feel happy. Instead, you are alone with your judgments, with your egotism and with your limited self. To reach the unlimited ecstatic self within us, we must overcome all feelings of both superiority and inferiority. Feelings of inferiority are simply another manifestation of the ego in disguise. I'm not asking you to be falsely humble and to avoid success, or to not do the things that you enjoy, Master Fuap said with a hearty laugh. That is not the tantric way. Simply realize that we all have different karmas, he explained. Some people have developed aspects of themselves, specific talents and abilities in this or in other lives, in ways that others have not. See and enjoy the differences and accomplishments of others. Enjoy your own struggles and successes too. If you want to be happy, avoid falling into the trap of egotism about what you do and who you perceive yourself to be, and don't be threatened or feel jealous of someone else because they can do something that you can't, or because they have something that you don't. Remember, we are all made up equally of the intelligent light of enlightenment. That light chooses to express itself uniquely through each one of us in its own mysterious and special fashion, for reasons that cannot be known here. You are correct. There is certainly a difference between desire and karma, he replied. Not that there's anything wrong with experiencing desires. He continued. Remember, desires are just another way that the universe expresses its love of itself, in and through us. Karma is the level of your awareness, what you are drawn toward in life, he explained. It won't go away until your level of awareness changes. It is like the earth circling the sun. As long as the sun's gravitational field is stronger than the earth's, the earth has to circle the sun. Your awareness, which is your karma, is what hooks you to things, Master Fuap explained. That is not the same as desire. Desire is a short-term pull toward an object, experience or some other aspect of life. Desire fades with time, sometimes even in minutes or within seconds of its fulfillment. Very few desires last for more than a few years, let alone for an entire incarnation. So when you are inexplicably pulled towards something, an experience, or someone, and that pull won't go away, that is how you can know that it is your karma, not simply another transient desire. And if it is an especially strong pull that won't go away, then it is probably from your past lives. And if you don't follow your karma, if you try to avoid it and run away from whatever your karma happens to be, you will never be happy or at peace with yourself, no matter what you do or achieve in this or in any other world. So what does all of this have to do with relational thinking, Master Fuap? Your mind has the ability to perceive both relationally and logically, he answered happily. Both methods of perception are good, and serve different purposes. The problem is that most people are taught to perceive things in only one way, logically. They never develop their innate ability to perceive things from the center of the circle. Now do you understand? I think so, Master Fuap, I said, somewhat hesitantly. Good, then please give me an example, he said with a big laugh. I paused for a minute to collect my thoughts. Sitting in silence, while I was trying to put together everything that Master Fuap had just said, I suddenly realized that I wasn't at all cold. I was just about to comment on the cave's surprising warmth, when I remembered that Master Fuap was patiently waiting for my answer to his question. Master Fuap, you are saying that the universe is one big mind, am I right? Exactly, he replied. And all of us are part of that big mind, and it is also a part of us. Yes, he agreed, please continue. Well, Relationally speaking, when I suspend my thoughts, I go into the second attention, and in my second attention, I see the universe differently from what you refer to as the center of the circle of perception. From there, I can draw from my current and past life knowledge, or directly from the second attention, which is the essential knowing of the universe. So if I was snowboarding down a mountain and a Buddhist monk suddenly appeared in front of me, instead of panicking and losing it like I did when I surfed you, I could flow with the experience. To do this, I would simply accept the fact that you were there, as if it were an everyday occurrence, not freak out, and deal with it from a deeper level of awareness. Is that right? You've got it, he said, and clapped his hands together in applause. We sat in the cave for a little while longer. Master Fuap told me that I needed time for my new understanding of relational thinking to sink in before we left the cave's helpful energy. Sitting in silence in the cave, next to Master Fuap, a variety of different sensations passed through my body and mind. At times I felt as if all the universe was part of me, and at other times I felt that I was a small part of it. We spent the next several days at the monastery with Master Fuap's monk friends, and I have never been so happy before or since. But that's another story for another chapter. Chapter 15, Peak Experiences. The ancient monastery was built into the side of a mountain cliff on the edge of the rhododendron forest. It housed 15 Buddhist monks, although, Master Fuap confided to me, it had once housed more than 100. It was made of stone, wood and plaster. Dozens of brightly colored prayer flags and stones carved with Om Mani Padme decorated its front courtyard. The meditation hall was large. I estimated that well over 100 monks could simultaneously meditate there. Behind and above the meditation hall were a kitchen and study rooms. We had arrived at sunset, just as the monastery lamps were being lit. As the two of us stood surveying the monastery, a pair of monks came out into the front courtyard and blew through to musical instruments that looked like 7-foot-long oboes. I can't say that the sounds they made were pleasing to me, but judging from the bright and happy expression on Master Fuap's face, he seemed to enjoy their music. Shortly after our arrival, all the monks came out to the courtyard to greet us. They smiled at me, and several of the younger monks came over directly to me and bowed. I observed, from their attentiveness to him, that the monks who lived in the monastery seemed to know, like and have a deep respect for Master Fuap. I also noticed that he acted differently around them than he did with me. He seemed more at ease. We were led to the kitchen, where we were seated at a long table with a number of the monks. They all laughed and chatted with Master Fuap in Nepali, while two of the younger monks served us both tea. After tea, Master Fuap and I were conducted to the north wing, and ushered into the room belonging to the head lama of the monastery. He was very old. He sat on a meditation couch in the large room that served as both his bedroom and office. He greeted me with a warm, broad smile. I liked him immediately. Despite his advanced years, there was something very youthful about him. He seemed to me to be very innocent and vulnerable. Master Fuap said something to him in a different language, and then the two of them started giggling like children. Later Master Fuap explained to me that the head lama, like himself, was Tibetan. They had been conversing and making jokes about me in their native language, so that only the two of them would understand. After a few minutes, one of the younger monks appeared noiselessly at the head lama's door, and conducted me to a different section of the monastery, where I would be staying. I was given a small room to stay in at the end of the south wing. It was sparsely furnished, and smelled perpetually of incense. In the center of the room was a cot. Built into one of the room's walls were two small chests of drawers made of a dark wood that resembled teak. In the front of the room, opposite the entryway door, hung a brightly colored thangka, depicting scenes from the life of the Buddha. I don't remember dreaming during the nights I slept in the monastery. My days were spent taking walks with the younger monks and helping around the kitchen. One of the younger monks who was about my age had undertaken the task of teaching me Nepali. In return, he asked me to teach him English. He and I spent our mornings and afternoons together, when I wasn't working in the kitchen, walking around the monastery grounds. His name was Ananda. In the little English that he spoke, he told me he was born in southwestern Nepal in a small village. He told me that he had lived in several other monasteries before coming here. He referred to the monastery we were in as the Cliff Monastery. He said he was 17 years old. I liked the routine of the monastery. Every morning we would get up with the sun. We bathed in a freezing cold waterfall that came roaring down the mountainside, and then after returning to the kitchen for hot buttered tea, we all would go to the meditation hall for morning meditation. The meditation hall was windowless. It was lit with dozens of small candles. The walls were covered with brightly colored thangkas that depicted Buddhas, gods, goddesses and other worldly scenes in fantastically complicated paintings. Each morning I would sit next to Master Thwap, facing the front of the hall in a cross-legged position, on a meditation cushion. At the front of the room, next to a statue of the Buddha, the head lama stood motionless until all of the other monks were present and seated. Then he would ring a small bell. Immediately everyone would close their eyes and enter into meditation. Trying to follow Master Thwap's instructions, I meditated as best I could. At the beginning of each session, I mostly thought. But partway through the morning meditation my thoughts would begin to slow and occasionally, for very short periods of time, they would completely stop. During these times I felt similar to the way that I had when I had been sitting next to Master Thwap in the Cave of Seeing. I could feel a perfect stillness within me. The universe seemed to melt into me and I into it. I felt as if I was a part of everything and I had no fear. I noticed that each morning, about 15 minutes after the meditation session had ended, everything became very shiny. My physical vision seemed to clear, and everything I saw became brighter and more precise. One morning after meditation, I asked Master Thwap about this phenomenon. He told me that things were always this bright, but that I needed my morning meditation to clear my mind enough to see just how beautiful life really was. Samadhi is the top of the mountain. One day, after we had been staying at the Cliff Monastery for about a week, Master Thwap and I spent an afternoon in the monastery garden. It was a sunny day, and I felt lazy and warm sitting in the garden with a cup of steaming buttered tea in my hand. Master Thwap was all smiles that day. He told me we would have to leave in a few days, and that I should enjoy the time we had left at the monastery. He remarked that this particular monastery was his favorite in all of the Himalayas. He said that he came here whenever he needed to clear his mind and rejuvenate his spirit. "Normally when I come here," he began, "I spend most of my time meditating in this garden. The luminous energy lines of this particular valley all converge right here in this garden. These energy lines are particularly conducive to samadhi." "Why is that?" I inquired. "Because they emanate from a dimension of perfect light," he replied with a bright and happy laugh. "As I told you in the Cave of Seeing, different physical locations are hooked to different dimensions. Buddhist monasteries are built on locations that interface with dimensions that are of the brightest and the most perfect light," he replied. "Look around you," he continued. "We are in a valley that is surrounded by the Himalayas on all sides. There is nothing else here except snow-covered mountains and the rhododendron forest. The only people who live here are Buddhist monks who constantly meditate on the Dharma, on the happiest thoughts and feelings in the universe. There is. But Master Thwap, is all of the higher energy here because of the luminous energy lines, or is the high energy here emanating from the meditating monks?" "Originally there were no monks and there was no monastery here," he responded. "There were only the Himalayas and the rhododendron forest. The dimensional planes that correspond to this valley we are in were then, and still are, made up of pure intelligent light. The Himalayas are filled with places like this," he continued. "And since there are few, if any, people around these locations, these places of power and enlightenment have remained relatively unpolluted by the aura of worldly human beings." "Master Thwap, are there other places like this outside the Himalayas?"
"Yes, there are quite a few on each continent, and also on some islands," he replied with a smile. but most of them have become so polluted by the cities that have been built near or on them that they cannot be used for achieving samadhi anymore. Why do you need a special place to experience samadhi? I asked. I thought that if you were enlightened you could go into samadhi in any location. If samadhi is a deep meditative state of mind, what does physical location have to do with achieving it? Master Fuap laughed delightedly at my question. I could tell he was amused by the fact that I had finally decided to ask him something about meditation, instead of my perpetual topic, snowboarding. There are really two issues involved here, Master Fuap began, and I want you to see them as complementary, not as being opposed or unrelated to each other. They are both equally important. The first issue is understanding what the samadhis are, and how they are attained. This is purely a technical understanding of meditation techniques and methods. The second issue is how the higher energies of parallel dimensions and power spots can be used to heighten overall spiritual awareness, and how they can make it easier for a person to experience the samadhis. Master Fuap, I thought you said that samadhi was the absence of thought. I've experienced that several times since we've been here, during my morning meditations. Does that mean I have been entering into samadhi already? Master Fuap laughed heartily. His eyes twinkled with delight as he said, No, I'm afraid that what you have experienced so far, in your early morning meditations, is a few good minutes of meditation, but not samadhi. Well, how can you tell what samadhi is? I asked, frustrated. Samadhi, Master Fuap replied, is, of course, the absence of thought. Let us say that the absence of thought is one of the indications that you have entered into a deep state of meditation. But there are several other aspects to the experience of samadhi that must also be present, if what you are experiencing is really samadhi. Let me begin by saying that the experience in meditation of samadhi is not a great achievement. In this world it is, however, a very rare achievement. Of all of the hundreds of thousands of Buddhist monks who meditate every day, only a handful of them are able to experience samadhi every time they meditate. According to our yogic traditions, samadhi means complete awareness of God, or to put it in less religious terms, samadhi means that your mind and the mind of the universe are, for a time, merged in an absolute ecstatic union. There are said to be three stages of samadhi: Salvikalpa Samadhi, Nirvikalpa Samadhi and Sahaja Samadhi. Salvikalpa Samadhi is like accidentally falling into a beautiful and pure lake of absolute bliss. You did not fall in intentionally, but you found it refreshing nevertheless. Nirvikalpa Samadhi is like intentionally diving into the same lake, and swimming and playing in it for a time. Sahaja Samadhi is like living on a houseboat in the middle of the lake of bliss, and occasionally coming ashore for supplies. To an extent, we experience the mind of God in all things. We experience it in the world that we see and feel every day, the people we know, the thoughts we think and in the emotions that we feel. The physical universes, astral dimensions and causal dimensions are simply different aspects of the mind of God. But when we experience life through our senses and with our thoughts, we don't experience its essential nature, its most pure and radiant form. Instead, we only experience the external veneer of life's ecstasy. Most of the water in a lake lies hidden beneath its surface, Master Fuap continued. In much the same way, only a small portion of life can be seen. The vast majority of life is non-physical, it exists beyond the physical surface of life, in other dimensions. If you want to experience life in its totality, it is necessary to enter into samadhi. Stopping your thoughts for a few minutes during meditation, which you have experienced several times in the meditation hall over the past few mornings, will give you a glimpse of the inner depths of infinity. But in samadhi, you gain more than a glimpse, you will experience the infinite, eternal and perfect depths of existence. The experience of samadhi is never the same twice. He continued. In some ways it is like climbing one of our Himalayan mountains. The weather conditions around a Himalayan mountain, and the amount of snow covering it, are constantly changing. Even though you may climb the same mountain again and again, you will never have exactly the same experience twice, because of the mountain's ever-changing climatic conditions.